session number 10763, reel 10.
And so I put it to him just like this, and he said, "Sir," he said, "I've got to do it, and if you'll give me the flight, I'll do the best I can." And I said, "All right, Bill, well, that's jolly good, and you'll do it." Now, he commanded that flight for the rest of, right up to May 45 in the armistice, and I haven't any doubt at all that every operation that he did was the hell of an effort for him, whereas there were some, and I had a lot of Canadians actually in the squadron who were sort of pretty rough and difficult, and that, I mean, I don't think that they felt anything like the same sort of stress and strain that Bill did, but he saw the blooming thing through, he stuck it and he saw it through, and at the end of it, in May 45, just as the armistice was coming up, and it was obvious that it was coming up, Basil Embry came down to visit the wing, 138 wing at Cambrai-Épinoy, and he came to the squadron, he came to our squadron headquarters and that, and he came into the office and had a talk with me, and he was very complimentary and all that about the squadron, and he said, "Is anything that you want to say to me?" And I said, "Yes, sir, there is. There's one thing, and I've put up various people for decorations, and you've been kind enough to get them. And there's one chap here who's squadron leader Duncan, who's been my flight commander," and I told him this story. And I said, "I've been through a lot in the war, and I've seen a lot of chaps get decorations, and which haven't been all that well deserved, and ones who failed to get decorations, which have been very well deserved, in my judgment. But I have never seen anyone. I mean, there's nothing that I can point to here, no particular operation, no bombing thing, nothing that I could simply pick out and say this fella deserves a gong for this or that. But this fella deserves a Distinguished Flying Cross because he's got stuck into it. He found it probably more difficult than anyone else in this squadron to do these operations and go on doing them. But he's done it, and he had all that awful experience in India before and so on, and he's done it, and he's seen it through, and he's going to stay in the service. And I would want to put him up for a DFC." And he said, "He'll get an immediate..." He looked me straight in the eye, old Basil. As I say, he got up and he said, "Is that all?" And I said, "Yes, that's all, sir, I want." And he looked me straight in the eye, nose, almost nose to nose, and he said, "He'll have an immediate DFC." And he got him one. I mean, he had a DFC within a day or a couple of days, and he went back and, my God, well, anyhow, dear old Bill, because I happened to be a golfer, I was playing immediately after the war was over. I was playing in the English Golf Championship down at Royal Mid Surrey at Richmond, and I'd gone on to about the last eight, I think, and I was playing in the last eight, a chap called Kenneth Tom, who I'd known, and I was one down, I think, playing the 14th, and there were a lot of people watching right down by the river there. I should think there were probably 800 or 1,000 people walking along. And I suddenly saw old Bill Duncan. And I said, "For Christ's sake, what are you doing, Bill?" And, it's just the last thing when you're trying to win a golf match with all these people and all that. But I mean, because I'd known him so well, I served him and I saw him there. And he was there with his wife. And he said, "Well, I saw in the paper you were playing." He said, "I just wanted to tell you that I'm leaving the service and I'm going to be a doctor." And I said, "For Christ's sake, you're leaving the service, and I mean, I'd really given the chap every sort of chance because I thought he was going to be a permanent commissioner, it was going to help him to have had this, but I mean, notwithstanding the fact I would still have done it if I thought that he was leaving the service, I think, or I might not have taken the risk." Anyway, he said, "Yes, I made up my mind, I'm going to be a doctor." I said, "But for Christ's sake, Bill, you're as old as I am. I mean, you're 32 or something," and I was 32, I think, then. And he said, "Oh, I know I am, and it'll take me 5 years, but I'm determined to do it." Anyway, he trained at George's, he passed all his MBs, and he became a doctor, and he emigrated with his wife from New Zealand. And he's been one of the most successful consultants, I suppose, that they've had in Christchurch. And is recognized to be. Now, he occasionally comes here. He always keeps it. We always exchange Christmas cards and probably a couple of letters in the course of the year. I'm terribly fond of Bill. He's such a nice man, and his wife is a super girl, Alison. And one time when he came here, I said, you know, Bill, I mean, it's so many years on now, but I can tell you exactly what I thought about you when you took this damn thing on. And, you know, after going through all that and then getting the gong and that, and then seeing you with them, oh, I'm in Surrey, for Christ's sake. Now, incidentally, I lost the match by 2-1. I mean, it didn't help me to win it. And I said, I was absolutely amazed when you took this decision. Well, he said, I'll tell you why I did, because after that experience that I'd had, I felt that if I went into medicine, I'd be able to help people who had mental problems. And he said, I really did have a mental problem. And I think that if you hadn't borne with me and given me this chance, and he said it was very difficult, I have to say, and I felt always sorry for my navigator, because I felt that he would have been much better off with a more sort of resilient pilot and that. If I hadn't been persevered with like that, he said, I don't think I should have changed. I should have probably stayed on in the Air Force and that would be the end of it in peacetime. But he was almost a sort of lack of moral fibre case, and yet he was probably the bravest of the whole bloody lot. And so that was why it was so terribly difficult to find. They make a terrible fuss about this LMF stuff. I mean, being lack of moral fibre was the most ghastly thing. And incidentally, if you ever got it truthfully in a squadron, I mean, you, particularly in those bomber squadrons where they had it much more, of course, although there was remarkably little of it. But don't forget, they were all volunteers. That was the difference. Every air crew was a volunteer. Never had to do it. He wasn't dragooned into it. And so I think that did have a very substantial effect. But I've always felt that it was one of those desperately difficult things. There were difficult. So all I can say is that this thing, coming back to what old Stuffy said about a squadron commander should never be appointed over the age of 26, I think there were times when, you know, I believe that it's all in the sort of puzzle of life. Some people are faced with things and being kept for things because there's still work to do, all that. I think that sometimes one, if one had had a bit more experience and so on, I'd had a lot of experience before I had this problem with those fellows in Malta, another problem probably as well, and Bill Duncan and whatnot. But I know exactly why he said it, because, of course, under the age of about 25, I mean, you go split-arsing all over them. You watch these fellas driving motor cars and riding motorbikes, of these sort of young guys of 18 or 19 or 20, and of course they don't have any sort of fear much in their bodies or minds. And that's really what he was after, I think. But I don't know. I think that there were other sides of it. I mean, after all, Douglas Bader became a squadron commander when he was 30. He fought in the Battle of Britain when he was there. He was born in 1910. He fought the Battle of Britain in 1940 as a CO of 242. And I know Dennis Crowley Milling, who flew number two to him in 242. He said, you know, Douglas, I mean, God almighty, he said he was 30 years old and I was 19 or something. And he said he might have been my grandfather. I mean, you could hardly dare speak to them. They were that sort of age. He said you got accustomed to squadron commanders of 24 or 25 or 23 or something. And he said, you've got someone of 30. He was, God damn it, he was sort of right for an old age pension or something. I mean, it's extraordinary, really, but anyhow, there we are.
Leaving the war for the moment and going on to the post-war period, I know that you worked in the Commons and was close to Churchill. Can you tell me some memories about him?
Well, the thing about Churchill was that, of course, I went into the House of Commons in 1950, and he was then leader of the opposition. Attlee had formed his second administration, and he had a very small majority of seven. And the Tory party in the House of Commons, then led by Winston, and the chief whip was Patrick Buchan-Hebben. And between the two of them, they actually ran that party like the sort of Prussian army. People never realised what it was like. I mean, the discipline that we were required to maintain there really was absolutely as strict as could possibly be. Anyway, old Winston, of course, had a lot of his cronies, but I don't suppose that he really on the front bench. He said, I honestly don't think he probably knew the names of more than about sort of 8 or 10 people. He'd know the principal people, obviously, but I mean, parliamentary secretaries, I don't think he probably knew very likely what they were doing or anything. So far as the back benches are concerned, well, apart from the people who'd been in the House of Commons for 25 or 30 years anyway, I mean, honestly, I don't think he knew who any of them were. But of course, we did have in that 1950 intake, we did have a lot of people who'd been in the services and done well in the Navy and the Army and the Air Force. And of course, he was all, because he'd been in the charge of Omdurman and all that, he was always very keen on people who'd fought. And I was pointed out to him one day, I was talking to Patrick Buchan-Hibben, who was the chief whip, became Lord Hales and the governor, I think, of Bermuda, or one of the Caribbean islands. And Earl Winston came up to him and obviously disregarded me completely, and didn't know who I was from Adam. And Patrick said to him, this is Naddy Lucas. He was in the Royal Air Force. And then he looked, turned to me and he said, indeed. He said, were you in the Royal Air Force? He said, where did you serve? Were you in the Battle of Britain? And I said, no, sir. I was learning to fly in Canada in the Battle of Britain. Well, he said, where did you go afterwards? You must have had some operation. I said, well, I was in the, commanded a squadron in the Battle of, oh, he said, in that jewel, he said, in the Mediterranean. He said, it sparkled, and I would never see it doused. I can always remember him saying. And that was, well, we had a little bit there, but I don't suppose he ever remembered who I was after that. But anyway, I remember we had one night, all night sitting. In the financial business in the House of Commons in those days, it's different now, but financial business could go on all night. I never had any time limit. And so when we took the committee stage of the finance bill, you knew that you were probably in for 8 or 9 days and probably 7 all-night sittings. That was about it. I mean, with Stafford Cripson, he was Chancellor of the Exchequer on the other side, and he was a sort of Torquemada. I mean, God bless you, he'd have you up all night. And it was always going to be fairly tough. Well, Earl Winston, who was then leader of the opposition, he had his room, naturally, the leader of the opposition's room, and he had a bed in it, and he'd come in at a sort of 11 o'clock and get up and make some speech on the finance bill, which he knew nothing about, and he would sort of knock about and everyone would laugh like hell. He was a marvellous parliamentarian, and no business to be probably talking on it, only some fellas on the other side. I mean, Sidney Silverman, who was always sort of trying to stir him up, because they got so much fun out of him, really. You know, I think the fun has gone out of the House of Commons quite a bit now. You don't see the humour. I mean, Churchill's humour and others' humour, and Bevan and so on, having a go at him, was all tremendously good-natured. And they used to stir him up, and so he'd get up in one of these sort of all-night sittings, you know, about 11 or 12 o'clock, he'd get up and make some intervention and recall what happened in his father's time there, you know, they'd all sort of shout it. And he enjoyed it, and then he'd go off and go to sleep. And of course, to hell with the votes which went on all through the night. I mean, they'd have him pad, and so he'd never have to. So he'd had a jolly good night's sleep when we'd been up all night. And I can remember one morning, we'd been up all night, and you know, for anyone who was working in a business outside, as I was, and getting to the office at 9 o'clock every morning, I mean, it was a hell of a job being up all night, then going, having a bath, and going straight to the office, and working away until half past 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and going to the House of Commons again for another all night sitting. Nearly exhausted you, but I can remember once we'd had one all night sitting, and I'd gone into the cafeteria in the house. The House of Commons had been rebuilt by then. You know, in the first Parliament, we sat in the House of Lords, and I can remember going to the cafeteria, and I was very hungry because I'd been up all night, and I'd been sort of working in the library or getting a speech ready or something for the weekend, and I thought, well, I'll have a decent breakfast. And so I got my tray and plates and knives and this, that, and the other, and I said, well, I'll have some cereal and I have bacon and eggs and a couple of pieces of toast and coffee and that, and butter and marmalade. And as I was doing this, and I was, you know, paid at the same time, I could smell a cigar, which was rather unpleasant at that time in the morning, actually. And I looked round, and here was Earl Winston standing behind me. And you know, I mean, immediately in those sort of days, I mean, you sort of regarded the old boy with the most tremendous reverence. I said, oh, I beg your pardon, sir. And he said, have you made your collection perfect and complete? I said, and he said to me, I bet that's better than it was in Malta. Now, you know, he'd got no idea what my name was. I bet you anything you like, if anyone said to him, who was that? He said, well, I don't know who he was, but anyway, I remember he was in Malta. So, you know, if you charged an Omdur man with him or fought in the Battle of Malta, you remember, I'd never forget it. But you felt with him that he was painting on an enormously broad canvas, and he could see things with a breadth that other people didn't. He made mistakes over small things, but over the big things he was very seldom wrong. And that last, I will always regard it, I mean, I have to say that he went on, you see, when he was re-elected in 1955 with a majority then of 17, I mean, it was a hell of a game, and then eventually he resigned in 55 when he was 80. But in March of 1955, and it's almost worthwhile turning it up in Hansard, we had a defence debate, and old Winston, and it was somewhere around about the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th of March 1955, and Winston opened it, and it was really on the basis of the justification of Britain's possession of the thermonuclear weapon. Don't forget the Attlee, and of course he had this great strength that the Attlee administration had manufactured it and so on, and so they couldn't be sort of shouting at him for going on with it and all that, otherwise they were simply prejudicing their own case. And so, but even so, you talk about these left-wingers and that about, but there were a hell of a lot of left-wingers then on the other side. I mean, it was very evenly divided in the House. I mean, it was 300 and something on either side. And there were the sort of Warbys and Ziliakises and Sidney Silvermans and these people. And they were always hammering at it. I mean, it was the Chinese were always doing right in Korea, you know, and all that, and we were always doing wrong, usual thing. And this particular debate was really, and from Winston's point of view, it was his theme was the justification of Britain's possession of the thermonuclear weapon. And because everyone knew that he was right at the end of his time, he was probably soon going to retire, the House was full for this, and he opened this, and I remember he had his tailcoat on, marvellous, the age of 80, the old boy. I mean, most of us had been saying he ought to have gone sort of 3 or 4 years ago, and I was one of the ones, I think, who paid lip service to that, because it seemed ridiculous, someone of that age going on. And he'd had a stroke, and he was frightfully deaf. And but I can see him that day, he'd got his tailcoat on, his polka dot tie, a beautiful white shirt, and a cufflink showing down here, and a beautifully cut coat. And I was sitting, not in the House, actually, I was sitting up in the members' gallery, but I always was interested, I frequently did on the great occasions, because I was always interested to see how the ministers worked their notes. And Winston's, of course, were the most beautifully prepared things. I mean, he had this parchment which fitted his pockets, you know, and he'd fit in, so when he walked into the House, he hadn't got any papers or anything with him, and then he'd stand up and he'd pull this thing out and pull the sort of stapler out through and put them down, and they were all set out like stanzas in a verse, and each line was a breath. The thing, Christopher Soames showed me, his PPS and his son-in-law showed me his thing one day, and I mean, I was absolutely fascinated by it. Anyway, this particular, and I, many times I admired it tremendously how he did it, and you know, every word almost that he uttered in the House of Commons, except the asides, which equally had been rehearsed, I'm quite sure of that, a lot of them had, because he could sort of anticipate what was happening, you can do that. I mean, everything that he uttered in the House of Commons on a prepared basis was always written down. That's why they read so marvellously. But the extraordinary thing about him was that he could really speak as well as he wrote, and he could write as well as he spoke. And at times in the 1922 committee or the Defence Committee, which he used to come to occasionally, you know, his speaking was marvellously contained and balanced within the rhythm. Anyway, this was his final contribution in the House of Commons, and I just regard it as one of the great privileges of my life to have been able to hear it at the age of 80, and he'd got this, and you know, the House of Commons is an extraordinary place with all those left wingers and this topic. You would have thought that they would have been up and interrupting and shouting at him, but they didn't. They realized that they were sort of in the presence of greatness, I think, and they never tried to interrupt him, as far as I can remember. Anyhow, it doesn't leave an impression of interruption, whereas a lot of other things did. And he had got to this, he did spoke for about 40 minutes, that's what he always did, sometimes he went a bit longer, and he'd got right down to the end of this complete justification. He'd made the case for Britain's retention of the thermonuclear weapon, and he came to his peroration, and I just wonder if I can remember it, I think I can, and turning to the speaker, and I think that was Shakes Morrison who was in the chair, and he said, "And so, Mr. Speaker, it may well be that by a process of sublime irony, safety shall become the sturdy child of terror, and survival the twin brother of annihilation." Now, and then he went on and said something or other which I didn't memorize afterwards, and he said, "And so, never fail, never think, never this, that, and the other." But I always remember that phrase, because that was the complete justification of the possession of the thermonuclear weapon, of the deterrent. And when you think that that was in 1955, and that's 30-something, 4 years ago, that is a complete vindication of the possession. And so it may well be that by a process of sublime irony, safety shall become the sturdy child of terror, and survival the twin brother of annihilation. It was the most marvellous thing. I mean, that stuff, they talk about never in the field of human conquest, or you know, all that, but I just felt, I listened to that, and because I have a feeling for words and love them and that, I thought to myself afterwards, you know, I sat there and I thought, well, it's the most marvellous thing just to have heard this old boy say this, because it's, I mean, it's an absolute jewel. But I can remember that stuff that he went on about Malta, the jewel, never douse. But it actually, of course, the experience that I had in the Air Force helped me very much in the House of Commons, because I was always interested in the, I always took part in the air estimates and all that. And when Anthony Eden resigned, had to, after Suez, and the House of Commons was in bits and pieces, Harold Macmillan then became Prime Minister, this was January 1957, and I was working in my office, the company had offices in Berkeley Square at the time, and I'd worked a bit with Macmillan, because he was the sort of shadow air minister, and he took a lot of interest, and we used to come to our committees and all that, and a telephone bell went in my office one morning, and I said, "Private Secretary to the Prime Minister, would you come and see the Prime Minister at 2:10 this afternoon?" And so I thought, well, I suppose he's going to offer me some sort of job. And I went down to the House of Commons, and I was then Assistant Managing Director of the company, and I had just signed a contract to be Managing Director of it for the next 5 years, and all the sort of pension arrangements made and so on. And anyhow, I went down to the House of Commons, and at 2 o'clock, parked my car in the New Palace Yard, and walked across from New Palace Yard across the Whitehall. And as I walked across, and I can always remember it, I saw a smoke trail, something high up, probably 26,000 or 27,000 feet. It was in January, and so probably it might not have been as high as that then. The trailing height probably was lower over the cold, and trail was going straight across from here to 10 Downing Street, you know, right on the line. Anyhow, I walked down Downing Street, and I walked in, and I was shown straight into the cabinet. Someone had come out, and someone was saying, "Well, congratulations to this chap," or whatever it was. And I walked in, and there was Macmillan sitting at the cabinet, where the Prime Minister sits at the cabinet table, or the armchair, you know, with his sort of great Mandarin eyes. He looked exhausted, Macmillan, actually, at the time. And he took his glasses off, and I can see him now holding this thing. I mean, he got the list, which the chief whip obviously had got out for him, for all these parliamentary secretaries, and he held this thing right up to his eye, you know, about here. And he looked at me and he said, "Now, dear boy," he said, "we want you to come and help us." He said, "I want you to go to the Air Ministry to help Geordie, with whom you've worked all these few years that you've been in the house." And that was Geordie Ward. And he said, "I hope you'll take it on." And you know, I said to him, "Well, Prime Minister, it's a dreadful thing to say, but I've just signed a 5-year contract with my company as a managing director of it. I've got young children I've got to educate, and I simply cannot afford to give up everything, all my... I mean, a parliamentary secretary in those days got 1,500 quid, and the House of Commons, I think, was 900 or something, or 1,000. I mean, 2,500. And I said, there is... I mean, it's a terrible thing to say, and I mean, I'd give my soul to be able to do it, to go and help Geordie, but I just simply cannot give all this up. And he turned to me, put his hand on my shoulder, and he said, "Dear boy, I understand." He said, "There's only one thing for it. Go away," he said, "make your fortune, and come back here in this chair in 10 years' time." I can, and it was one of the terrible disappointments in my life, but we all have them.